Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we welcome Sue Nitzke to the microphones. She's an emerita professor of extension and nutritional sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Chaired that department for a long, long time, nutritional sciences, and comes on every so often to talk with us about healthy eating and nutrition in one way or another. And today we're going to take a look at how to be successful with those resolutions you may have made to eat better and maybe to lose weight in 2012. It's something that's in the forefront of my little brain, and it may be in yours as well. You may have some questions, maybe some experiences to share as we move along today, and I hope you'll join in with those questions or experiences at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, and don't forget you can go to my Facebook page as well. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a comment or a question there. And also, we have a couple of related articles for today. One from, actually Sue provided both of them, that relate to the whole topic of losing weight and keeping it off. One's called The Fat Trap, and the other is a series of suggestions, tips to avoid winter weight gain, news from Co-op Extension. So those are up on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and I strongly encourage you to take a look at them because there's lots of really good information in both those pieces. Again, join us at 800-642-1234. Sue, great to have you back.
I'm happy to be here, Larry.
I wonder how many people in this country make the resolution, I'm going to eat healthier, I'm going to lose weight in the new year.
You know, it's just a phenomenon, you know, and good for people for giving it a try and for having good intentions. I think many people really get off to a good start. And, you know, now we're in the middle of January and it's getting kind of old and some of us have totally forgotten and others of us are getting frustrated. So I have some suggestions. I think one of my first suggestions is to be really specific about what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to eat better. Well, that's kind of fine, but you never get
what
to
does
perfection
that mean?
There. So maybe it's just I'm going to buy more whole grain cereals at the store,
mm-hmm.
or I'm going to be more careful about the beverages I drink, or I'm going to keep track of my calories for a week and identify three places where I can, you know, cut back, or I'm going to take an extra walk each week with my dog, or
mm-hmm.
something that you can sort of check off. Yes, I did it.
Okay, did that.
Rather
yep.
than I'm just going to be a better person.
mm-hmm. So that's, yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. So it's this whole business about keeping active, I guess. You're not going to, probably not going to lose weight or even maintain weight if you sit in front of the television set an awful lot.
You know, there's many things that we can do to help have healthier eating habits and to get more exercise. And just doing one or two of those things by themselves probably isn't going to result in much weight loss, but they can still make your body healthier. And exercise is a great example of that. People who stay at the same weight or maybe just lose a couple pounds while they're getting more exercise, you know, if they're serious about it, they can lower their blood pressure. They can have better cholesterol levels. They can avoid a condition called metabolic syndrome or even diabetes if they're really diligent about getting enough exercise. And I think this winter weather that we're finally getting in Wisconsin makes it a little harder. So you have to kind of plan and think ahead and, you know, what are my opportunities for exercise? There's maybe not quite as many in the winter, but I bet there's things that everybody enjoys that they can go, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. I can still do X. You know, when I go to the mall, I can incorporate an extra 20 minutes of walking while I'm in there anyway. Just make sure I have some comfortable shoes on and go do my thing. Or, you know, in my case, I have a dog. So
that's easy.
That's a built-in source of exercise. She doesn't care if it's snowing or cold or windy. She wants to go for a walk. So, you know, out we go.
Yeah. And, well, you know, yesterday we were sliding on a hill with my 8-year-old. They had a great time up and down the hill.
I drove on Milwaukee Street, I think it was yesterday, coming back from the grocery store, and that little sledding hill that they have on Milwaukee Street, I don't know how they could have gotten one more little kid on it. It was just as full as it could be. And, you know, going out sledding with your kids and walking up that hill 10 times,
that was fun.
You know, good. That's a good way to get started, too.
Oh, it was actually, it was a lot of fun. And now we can get the cross-country skis out, too. So those are some things that we're looking forward to doing. Do you, you know, I've heard and I've seen, and you may have recommended keeping a log or trying to keep a log of what you eat. But, you know, to me, that would be almost that would be a hard hard thing for me to do.
Oh, Larry, you don't have to do it for the rest of your life. What we recommend, maybe 2 days, maybe 3 days a week if you're really into it, just writing down everything you ate and keeping track of whether you were eating because you were hungry and it was time to eat, or if it's something you were doing automatically because, like, maybe there was a football game on yesterday and you sit down with a bunch of food that you're not really hungry for.
Well, that would be depressing. Yeah. Depression would cause people to eat more.
Yes, yeah. And after the game, settling your feelings of distress with, some kind of treat. You know, those are things that sometimes we get into just habits of eating unconsciously.
Yeah.
And many times what we eat during those occasions are things like chips and, you know, candies and, cheeses and crackers and salami. Not that those aren't decent foods, but eating them when you're not hungry is not the best way to go. So, for instance, we had a friend over to watch the game yesterday, and I put out, those pea pods that you can buy that are just ready to eat and all. Those with a little dip made with yogurt.
I love those things.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you're munching away, you're not, you'd have to really eat a ton of those before it amounted to many calories. So I had those out with along with other things so we didn't overeat on such an auspicious occasion.
I have a friend who's on a program now to lose. He's lost about 30 pounds. I forget over. He loses a couple pounds a week. But the one thing that he, as part of this plan, is they let him, he can eat as many vegetables as he wants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's got to watch other things, but vegetables he can eat.
Right. A lot of these diet plans that have points will just let you have free rein on vegetables as long as they're not starchy vegetables like potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great thing. Why not let people just have a ball with their broccoli or their carrot sticks or whatever it is? You know, so you don't feel like, you know, if you really have the munchies,
with them all the time, I think.
You know, go for it. Yeah, that should be considered free food. And, you know, there's fiber in there, and it helps you feel kind of satisfied, and you're able to munch on something.
Mm-hmm.
Popcorn is another thing that can really kind of keep you occupied if you really feel like you have to be eating. And
that's what we
grain.
Had yesterday during
there
the game.
You are.
We had some pop, a couple of bowls of it, actually, as I recall.
Yeah, and, you know, what is a cup of popcorn is like 30 calories or something, you know what I mean? It's a good way if you really feel like you have to be munching on something to get some nutrition in the process, because it's a high-fiber food. And really not, unless you load it up with butter or something, it's going to be just fine.
Sue Ditzke, nutrition specialist, our guest today. And you can join in. Are you happy with your weight where it is, or would you like to lose some? How do you know? How much do you know about eating healthy? Let's put it that way. How hard is it for you to stick with an eating plan? Maybe what's your biggest weakness? Are there triggers that send you to the fridge or the pantry for your favorite weakness? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Miller Show. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call. Shoot us an email. Go to the Facebook page. You can do it all of those ways or any of those ways. We have one of the things I tried to do yesterday because of it was the game and it's exciting, was to watch my liquid intake,
mm-hmm.
the calorie intake. So I was drinking water.
Mm-hmm. We served sparkling water with lime slices at the game, along with, beer and some other soft drinks, so that there was really a kind of a special beverage without having it be a high-calorie beverage. And some of us switched off between having, a beer and then having the sparkling water. And that way it just cuts your alcohol intake in half and your calorie intake in half just by doing that. And it's not suffering.
Is there, I'm wondering about the no-calorie or the diet soft drinks. Is there anything wrong with using those a lot during the course of a day or a week?
Not inherently, but they're also not inherently going to make you lose weight. No. There's been some pretty specific studies done looking into this notion that low-calorie beverages somehow make people gain weight. One of the theories is they kind of encourage your sweet tooth by giving you a sweet flavor, and then you're still going to seek out some sugar after it or something like that. It's just kind of a made-up theory, I think.
Yeah.
But this, the evidence hasn't really borne that out. And what a very comprehensive review article showed is that if you use diet sodas or no-calorie beverages as part of a specific plan that you're following to lose weight, you'll lose weight faster than not using them. But if you're just sort of drinking diet soda because it's there, it's not going to cut your calorie intake. It doesn't reduce your hunger mechanisms and all of that. So it's sort of neutral if you're not part of a plan, or a useful tool if you actually are trying to lose weight.
Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the articles that you handed on to me and that we posted on our on the Facebook page at the Larry Miller Show, and that's called The Fat Trap. And that was a depressing, it is a depressing piece in many respects.
Well, nutritionists and dietitians like myself we really try to help people who want to lose weight. And you want to be a cheerleader and you want to help motivate people. But people have to realize that if you actually lose 10% of your body weight, you're going to have to change your lifestyle and be on a permanent plan that takes in about, somewhere between 250 and 400 calories less per day forever. It's not like they show it on TV like, I'll drink these shakes for a few weeks and then I'll be beautiful and life will be great. It's like you really have to work at it and you just have to keep at it or it's going to come creeping back. And I don't know many dieters who haven't experienced the creeping back phenomenon. Yeah. And it's really frustrating and disheartening. But if you really think of some lifestyle changes that you can make and that'll be just as much enjoyable next year as they are this year, like doing the extra walk at the mall or whatever those things are, or in your case, getting out your cross-country skis, in my case, snowshoes. If you do those things more consciously and pick things that you can do for a long time, then you're much more likely to be successful. And a combination of diet and exercise has been shown over and over to be more helpful at long-term weight loss than either one of those by themselves.
Yeah. Sue Nitzky, our guest today, talking with her about how to be successful with resolutions to eat better and lose weight. You can certainly join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show, and you could post a comment there. I'm Larry Miller. Marika Soval, our on-air producer today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network. Larry Miller here with my guest, Susan Nitzky, Emerita Professor of Extension in Nutritional Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Certainly, if you'd like to join in with some questions or comments here as we talk about weight, happy with your weight, like to lose some weight perhaps, Know how and why to eat healthy? How hard is it for you to stick with a plan? Not just dieting, but then there's a maintenance, we call maintenance plan. Join in. I'd love to hear what you have to say. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show, and you can post your questions or your comments there. You've got a plate super tracker that uses, and I thought it was pretty cool. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture always has some resources online to help people follow the dietary guidelines. It used to be called My Pyramid.
Yep.
And the last time around when the dietary guidelines reserved, the USDA changed it to the My Plate system.
Yep.
So you might remember Mrs. Obama had a kind of a launching and talked about, you know, making half your plate fruits and vegetables and all of those things. That's part of the system. We just mentioned that it's a good idea to keep a track of your intake for a few days. This is an online system where you can keep track of your food intake and or your exercise and really look at where your strengths and weaknesses are and make some plans and follow through with those plans. You can register and keep track, and it shows you little graphs of how you're doing and compares it to the dietary guidelines and says, oh, maybe you should get a little more fiber and here's some sources and that sort of thing. And it's all free. It's just at myplate.gov or choosemyplate.gov. Either one of those will get you there. And also lots of people have applications that they can put on their smartphones or things they can find on their computers. So there's all kinds of little handy tools to make it kind of fun to keep track of how you're doing.
I'm sure there are plenty of apps out there now.
Absolutely. There are hundreds of them.
Well, yeah, and I don't have any of them yet.
Oh, well, I use the MyPlate system now and then because it's free and it works for me. But I have a friend who is just kind of a technological junkie, and he just writes every little thing into his iPhone application and just thinks it's just so much fun. So, you know, go George.
Well, I wanted to go back to that to some of the research here on that has been done. I know there was a study of obese people losing, they lost 30 pounds in something like 10 weeks, so about 3 pounds a week, which is on a weight
That's
loss.
That's pretty drastic, but yeah.
It's fairly drastic, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
But then they followed them after that period, and what happened?
Well, this was a study that got a lot of attention. It was just published last fall in the New England Journal of Medicine. And, you know, to get into that journal, it's a very fussy medical journal, and they only take really well-conducted studies. And this researcher had people losing this weight, as I mentioned, 30 pounds in 10 weeks. And then they had, I think they were using a liquid diet product and they were following a very specific regimen. And then his team gave a lot of personal counseling and coaching and said, okay, that part of the diet is over and now let's, you know, be really good and get our exercise and eat well with regular food and so on and so forth. And even with all of that kind of helpful intervention from experts, people still gained an average, regained an average of 12 pounds by the end of the year. So
they got almost half of it back.
Yeah, and what was so important about this study is during that whole process, they were tracking blood levels of various hormones. These are not the hormones you might think of in the big picture of hormones that we learned about 20 years ago, but hormones that have been involved in the hunger and appetite process. One of them is called ghrelin, which I think we've heard a lot about. It's sometimes called the hunger hormone.
Yeah.
And those levels increased in these subjects after they lost weight. And the other hormones that act as sort of appetite suppressants, one is called peptide YY, and the other is leptin. And both of those went down. So this has actually been called by some, it's been given a name, post-dieting syndrome. Isn't that depressing?
No, yeah.
So, you know, it's almost like, and that's what this New York Times article that I shared with you and that you put up on your Facebook page makes a big deal of, about how, you know, it seems like your body's working against you when you gain weight. And that's why I said you really have to make plans to make long-term changes that you can stick with and kind of in spite of these. As some people report just actual cravings. Some people think they're addicted to food. I don't know if it goes that far. But, you know, even some brain scan kind of studies where they've followed people after weight loss show that the interest in food and the emotional reaction to pictures of food and things like that are stronger after a person has been on a diet to lose a significant amount of weight. So you have to, you know, you have to be prepared for that and have a plan that's going to help you out in the long term. Otherwise, you'll be what we used to call a yo-yo dieter. You'll go up, you'll go down, you'll go up and you'll go down. And, you know, that might be better than nothing at all, but really a steady, at least avoid weight gain if you can't do anything else. Because once you've put it on and kept it on for a little while, that's when this sort
that's
of losing it and triggering the hunger sets in. So you're way better not getting started with that whole thing. And that actually leads to why I think it's so important, something we forget all the time is with little kids, you know, help them develop the kinds of habits that are going to keep them healthy and not have them deal with excess weight gain before they even know what happened. You know, that's, I just think
so
it's just
them,
so important. Yeah.
Yeah. So keep it. So, and so what are some things? Now we have an 8-year old and she is in very, I think anything, she's a little underweight. She might, she's in a lot of sports and, we don't, she doesn't eat a lot of, certainly doesn't eat a lot of candy or anything like that. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, on trick or treat, Halloween time, she goes and collects all this candy, but then, the great pumpkin comes during the night and she gets to pick a few pieces of candy and then the great pumpkin comes, during the night while she's asleep and takes all the rest of the candy to give to others and leaves a little gift for her for leaving all that candy.
Oh, isn't that's that a nice tradition? Thing. Yeah. Good idea. Yeah. Some families just put it all in the freezer, you know, so you have to sort of take it out if you really want some and wait for it to thaw. And by that time, you've forgotten about it. Yeah. You know, there's lots of things we can do. And a special occasion like Halloween, I don't get too excited about. But it seems like we've gotten into the notion now that treats should be a daily thing. And every meal has to end with something sweet. And drinking sweetened beverages all day long is something I see children do that I think is just a recipe for disaster. It's really establishing a habit that's going to be hard to break. There's nothing wrong with water between meals and a good glass of milk with your meals. You know, and a soda now and then, fine, but not these big gulp things with like 300 calories of a pop on a daily basis. Getting kids used to beverages that are high in calories that don't have the satiety value of a sandwich or something like that with the same calorie intake.
Yeah.
I think it's just really asking for trouble. And some kids are more susceptible to weight gain than others, and it's going to put them at a disadvantage. And, of course, keeping them active, because nowadays schools can't always do all the physical education programs they used to with budget cuts and so forth and focusing on test scores and things. So helping kids have a way to be active, you know, especially kids who live in a downtown area where it might not be safe to be out on the sidewalks or in the playgrounds after school without an adult around. All of the things that one person can do to help the kids in their neighborhood or one grandparent can do to help kids be more active with their grandchild after school or something like that, those can all make a difference.
And absolutely.
Establishing healthy habits at a very young age is never a bad investment.
We have an email from Laura who said last year, excuse me, I stopped drinking one to two Diet Mountain Dews a day. So she was drinking the Diet Mountain Dews, but she noticed that it cut down her cravings for sweets and her stomach stopped feeling kind of bloated. So,
Well, Mountain Dew has a couple of things going on. One is the Diet Mountain Dew, of course, has that sweet flavor. And I said there's still this theory floating around that just feeding is the wrong term, but not literally feeding your sweet tooth, but maintaining a sweet tooth by having sweet beverages all the time. There might be something to that. We haven't been able to verify it with research. The other thing is Mountain Dew has a lot of caffeine in it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, depending on what your other beverages are over the day, if you've started out the day with a couple of cups of coffee and then you start drinking Mountain Dew and, you know, now they have these energy drinks that a lot of them have caffeine in them. And I think there are many people out there who just don't realize how much they're stimulating their nervous system with all of this caffeine. And a little caffeine is fine. Everybody, Zorba Pastor over the weekend was saying, you know, have a couple cups of coffee. There's nothing wrong with it. And I agree with that. But nowadays, the caffeine is sort of everywhere and it's really easily overdone.
Sue Nitzke, our guest today, you can join in too with an email at talk@WPR.org. You can also send us a note on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show or give us a call. I'm surprised you don't have any callers up here at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You happy with your weight where it is, or maybe you'd like to lose some? Do you know how and why to eat healthy? How hard is it for you to stick with a plan? I have some questions about your children or maybe your grandchildren and their eating habits. Give us a call. Again, that's 1-800-642-1234. An email from Paul. Two things we don't seem to be addressing as major issues are glycemic load and the out-of-whack omega-6, omega-3 ratios of our animal products, meat and dairy. Currently, a typical American has a fairly fatty acid omega 6 to 3 ratio, slightly over 16 to 1. He feels or comments that a reasonable ratio might be 2 to 1.
What the exact ratio is under some scrutiny right now, and I don't think the experts feel like they have enough evidence, but the principle behind what this commenter has to say is important. I mentioned a little while ago the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, and the latest edition that came out at the end of the year 2010 talks a lot about having a good balance of fat intake. Most Americans get a little more fat than they need in their or than is recommended for their diet on an overall basis. And like this person suggested, the amount of omega-3s isn't as high as it should be. The liquid fish oils and some of the oils from seeds like flaxseed and some other sources, even canola oil is a fairly decent source. So that's one of the reasons why we're having salmon for dinner tonight, if you can afford it, or any of the fatty fish. Some of them are quite a bit cheaper. Are good sources of omega-3 fatty acids, and they're the most valuable kind of omega-3 fatty acids because it's the long chain variation that your body can just take up and use right away. If you get your omega-3 fatty acids from vegetable sources, like I mentioned, the flaxseed, then your body has to use some enzymes to, it's a longase enzyme that has to convert those fatty acids to a longer chain version before they're actually ready to go into your cells. And for one reason or another, omega-3 fatty acids, especially eating fatty fish twice a day like the Heart Association recommends, has been over and over in epidemiological studies shown to be associated with lower risk of heart problems and just a healthier diet overall. So that's one of the principles this Facebook commenter mentioned. The other one is glycemic load. There are two measures of the speed with which your carbohydrate intake enters your body and gets turned into glucose in your bloodstream. And one of them is called the glycemic index, and one is glycemic load. The glycemic load takes into account the speed and the amount. The glycemic index is just the speed. It's kind of technical stuff. But both of them are trying to get at the principle that if you eat sugars versus foods with fiber and more complex carbohydrates in them, the sugar just enters your bloodstream immediately. There might not be such a phenomenon as a sugar high like a lot of people think, but it's a quick shot of blood glucose that then your body has to handle. And anyone with diabetes or metabolic syndrome or some related problems knows that quick influx of sugar into your bloodstream is not a healthy thing. And
right.
Your body has to invoke a lot of hormonal systems to handle it. And anyone with diabetes is going to have trouble with that. So the glycemic index and glycemic load have been researched a lot. They're the basis of a lot of popular books about nutrition and dieting that are out there. But in a practical sense, we really haven't found a good way to make them work for just the general public.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't see a lot of mainstream nutritionists making a big deal out of the glycemic index and glycemic load.
Yeah.
Not as much as you see in the popular press or the diet plans that you see advertised on TV. So I'm not saying it's a bogus measure. It's a real measure. It has some value. But how to make it really practical for the public, I don't think we're there yet. So let me tell you what's behind what I'm saying here. If you eat one slice of bread, it's arbitrarily the speed with which that carbohydrate gets into your bloodstream is given a number like 100.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you eat rice, it's like 110. And if you eat cookies, it's like 120. And if you eat brown rice, it's 100 or it's 80. You know,
mm-hmm.
So it's a measure of the speed. That's the glycemic index. And that's all well and good, but by the time you eat a meal where the rice is mixed in with something or
yeah.
has some gravy on top or something like that, the whole concept goes out the window. And there's some very, even just saying, okay, a potato has a glycemic index of X, it's anywhere from 80 to 120 depending on what kind of potato it is and
yeah.
whether it's boiled and how long it was boiled and, you
how
know,
big it was to begin with.
Well, just lots of factors. So it's a really kind of a sloppy indication of a measurement that's probably real, but that you can't predict very well just using a chart. And in the end, I'd just really like to have people spend more time thinking about how can I eat lots of fruits and vegetables. You know, make half your mm-hmm. plate fruits and vegetables. It's a really easy concept to remember. The MyPlate system talks about getting your whole grains every day, getting low-fat milk or some other good source of calcium in your diet every day, getting a variety of protein sources, not that meat is good for you or bad for you, but that it just should be one of a variety of protein sources if you're a meat eater. You know, those kinds of things, along with eating lots of fruits and vegetables and just not overdoing the high-calorie beverages and sweet drinks, just doing those things without making a lot of calculations and counting and all of those things, but just kind of conceptually keeping those principles in mind can make a huge difference in the quality of your diet.
Let's take some calls. Lynette in Richfield, we'll go to you first here. Lynette, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have two comments that I'd like to hear what you think of that. One was I recently read an article about teaching children healthy eating habits and how once that's imprinted on them by the age of 15, we're gonna see a downswing in the diabetes and obesity problem if we can teach children healthy eating habits prior to the age of 15. And then my second comment was, I had just seen a show on the Food Network the other day, Restaurant Impossible with Robert Irvine, and he had gone into a high school to revamp their culinary program and having the students run the kitchen, and how successful that program was. And I was wondering what your comment would be on implementing something like that through our school cafeteria programs.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate your comments, and Lynette, both of these topics, I think, are just so important. I'll try to be brief because I want to talk for an hour on each one. Lynette used the term imprinting, and I think that's actually a kind of an intriguing way to refer to helping little kids develop healthy eating habits. Studies show over and over again that we learn to prefer the tastes that we're familiar with, and we'll seek them out over and over again. And little kids who are used to eating marshmallow-colored sugar pop cereal every day, that's what they're going to think breakfast is supposed to be like, unless something else intervenes, for maybe even forever. Whereas kids who learn to eat non-sugared yogurt and whole grain cereals without a lot of sugar, that's what tastes good to them, because it's so familiar. It just becomes what you think your food and your meals are supposed to be like. So starting this out with little kids is really getting a leg up on the nutrition problems of our country. And then, as Lynette mentioned, when kids get to school, some schools spend a lot of their resources trying to have healthy food for their kids, and some schools just try to do it as cheap as they can.
Mm-hmm.
There are federal laws that have to be followed about what the composition of a school meal is, but it still gives a lot of wiggle room, and I think some schools just aren't as conscientious as they should be about trying to help kids have healthy eating habits all day long, including the school lunches and other meal programs. Now, whether or not turning it over to the kids and having them make the meals is the way to go, I mean, that can be certainly a learning experience. There are a lot of food safety issues and regulations that have to be followed, and things for that to be practical for every school
sure.
to do. But if it's done right, I could see that it could be a really great teaching experience for the kids, get them excited about the meal program, getting them interested in what's served and thinking about whether it's good for them and that sort of thing, which is all a step in the right direction. So good for that school.
Sue Nitzke, our guest today, emerita professor and extension specialist in nutritional sciences. She is author of Rethinking Nutrition, Connecting Science and Practice in Early Childhood Settings. And here to answer your calls right up until 12 o'clock today. We will be going at noon for a live Wisconsin Public Radio broadcast of the Martin Luther King Jr. event from the state capitol. Begins at noon today. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking eating healthy today and how to make a successful resolution to eat better and lose weight with our guest Susan Nitzke of the UW Extension and Department of Nutritional Sciences. She's an emerita professor there. And Bruce in Milwaukee is up next with a question for you, Sue. So let's go there. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Sue. Glad to have you back on the air again.
Thank you.
I am calling about naturally thin people, and what I've read is that they have a genetic abnormality in which they don't process fats well or metabolize fats properly. I'm wondering if you're familiar with that, what it might be called, and where I might find some more information about it.
Well, there's a theory called biological determinism, and that's a fancy term for what we seem to be understanding more and more, is that some people are susceptible to gaining weight when they eat a certain amount of calories, and other people would be either staying the same or losing weight on that same amount of calories, even though they all weighed the same when they started. And they're finding some genetic markers now that go along with this phenomenon. One of the ones that's being studied, I don't even know what the letters stand for, but it's the FTO gene. So I think what you're talking about, Bruce, is a real phenomenon. I think we all know people. It's like, how can they eat all of that and be so thin?
Yeah.
And I even read a study just in the last week or two that says that something we've known about for a long time. I'm talking 30 years. It's called brown fat. It's adipose tissue that's more metabolically active than most of the fat in our body that's just involved with storing extra calories. And we used to think that you had some brown fat when you were born, but, you know, if you're a human as opposed to a hibernating animal that uses brown fat to stay alive over the winter, you lose your brown fat and it's just not relevant. Well, now they're taking another look. I don't know if it's going to be the answer to why some people are thinner than others, but it might be that some people have some more metabolically active adipose tissues than others. And in fact, I think a lot of people who study obesity professionally as researchers are really kind of getting excited about looking again at all the different ways that adipose tissue influences what's going on in our bodies rather than just being sort of a inert fat storage system as we used to regard it up until a few years ago.
Thank you very much for calling. An email from Peter who was wondering if you could comment about the value of eggs. And sort of the follow-up to that was, does eating the whites really do anything?
Oh, you know, what a great question, Peter. You happen to be asking a person who has chickens in her backyard, so I'm very interested in eggs. Many years ago, we were kind of afraid of eggs because they're high in cholesterol. And we knew from studies where you feed pure cholesterol that eating a lot of cholesterol can increase heart disease risk. But it's never really been shown with eggs. And in fact, epidemiological studies show that eating lots of eggs really, for most people, is kind of neutral in how it affects heart disease. There's many different biological variations from person to person and how susceptible they are to the cholesterol in their diet. But for most people, eggs are just another healthy source of protein that if you don't overdo it, and the Heart Association is now saying for normal people and the dietary guidelines, an egg a day, including the yolk, should be just fine. If you're worried about the extra calories, because that is where the fat is stored in the egg, then you might maybe just eat every other yolk or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there's no kind of comprehensive, consistent evidence that the normal average American has to avoid egg yolks.
Gloria in Milwaukee has a question for you, Sue. Let's go there. Hi, Gloria.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a problem of not losing weight, but of trying to gain weight.
Yes, there are people like you in the world. They're fewer and fewer every year. But, yeah, gaining weight can be a real challenge for some people. The person who has the office next to mine on campus, I talk to her all the time and say, how come you're not fat? Because, she can eat a lot and not gain weight. And she's one of these people we call a fidgeter. You know, if we're both sitting at our desk and doing our work for 8 or 10 hours a day, I bet she burns twice as many calories as I do because she's just always kind of moving, you know, and I'm just, unless I'm thinking about it, I'm sitting there like a lump. And we've decided that that's the difference. But whatever's the cause, if you want to gain weight, the obvious way is to eat more calories, which if you're not hungry for more calories is easier said than done.
Right.
So what you have to do is find foods that are reasonably healthy, but that are also calorically dense. So, and try to eat as much of them at times that don't interfere with your ability to eat more later. So you might space out your eating so that every 2 to 3 hours you're eating the equivalent of a small meal, and making sure that there are, you know, some maybe oatmeal for breakfast, which I think of as something to help with weight loss. But if you're trying to gain weight, it can also be helpful because you can eat a little extra of it.
That's what I usually have for breakfast is oatmeal or a big dish of cereal with fruit in it. But I'm 5'5" and I weighed up to 115, but then I dropped down to 106 and I thought there was something wrong. So I have my doctor do all the tests and things are fine. I did have to have a medication for the acid reflex.
And I'd
lost my appetite completely, but now, since I've been on that medication, I'm hungry. But I don't know what to eat that would really help me to put on those extra pounds.
So what you do is you look at all the recommendations for what Larry and I should eat. You know what I mean? It's healthy foods for everyone. But pick out the what we call calorically dense, or the ones that aren't real watery and the ones that aren't super high in fiber or, you know, fluffy. So whereas yesterday Larry and I were eating popcorn, maybe you could have had some crackers and, you know, really things that don't fill
cheese.
You up as fast. And cheese, sure, go for it. And just make sure you still get a balance throughout the day, but eat more of everything in a way that spreads your intake out throughout the day so that you take maximum advantage of feeling like eating, or at least not being averse to eating, and just make it something that you do even if you're hungry isn't driving you to go looking through the cupboards just yet.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Kristen emailed, what are some good sources of plant proteins other than legumes and nuts? I'm trying to reduce my meat intake, but I absolutely hate all forms of beans and nuts. I don't even like hummus. Chickpeas or lentils, and it's not for a lack of trying them. So,
well, peas and beans would have been my first recommendation.
Yeah.
They're sort of a vegetarian's best friend. Plant proteins. Well, have you tried quinoa? It's actually eaten like a grain, kind of like a rice substitute. It's pronounced quinoa, but it's spelled the first letter is a Q. And you can find it at bigger grocery stores. And you can cook it up like barley or rice or that sort of thing. And it's a pretty high protein source. You mentioned plant protein, so I suppose that means you don't want to have like yogurt or cheeses or some, you know, the low-fat cheeses can also be good protein sources, and that you don't want fish, you won't eat eggs, and you didn't want nuts. So basically you're down to seeds. So any plant source that is high in a seed content other than peas and beans, which you don't like, try those. Sesame seeds. That's one of the ingredients of a lot of dishes, especially some of the Asian dishes. And you might find you can get a lot of protein there. So that's what I'll encourage you to do, is look for more recipes and dishes that have seeds in them.
Emily has a 2- and 3-year-old who are at the age of very picky eating. Try to make sure there are always fruits and veggies on their plates, but they just flat out refuse to touch them.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas as to how to get them to try nutritious foods?
Oh, Emily, that is a question we get all the time. The first thing to know is that 2- to 3-year-olds are just naturally in a stage where they're not, for their size, growing as fast as they used to. So it just might seem like they've become a picky eater when really they just don't need as much food and they're not as hungry. Also, they're at a stage where it's really fun to test your limits and to see how you can get your way. So if you go to the meal and go, oh, I'm not hungry for this, I don't want to eat that, and you pick at your hamburger and you pick at your vegetables, and then a half an hour later you're trying to snatch the cookie jar, you know, it's kind of a way to see, you know, so is whoever feeding me really serious about wanting me to eat real food versus treats all day long? And you have to be on to that. So what Ellen Satter recommends, who's a local author on these subjects who I admire and a lot of people think is onto the right track, she's both a dietitian and a social worker. She says, you know, you are the person in charge of what's available to eat and when it's served. And you have to be reasonable and reliable about that. You have to have well-timed meals and good healthy snacks available between meals, not right before a meal, but in between. And then whether the children eat it is something that's totally up to them, and you don't have a strong reaction one way or the other if they try to get your attention by refusing to eat or demanding to eat certain things. And after a few weeks, they'll be on to some other way of testing their limits.
Oh, well, what do you think of raw food diets, vegetables, fruits, and nuts?
I think raw foods are great, and I think cooked foods are great. I think raw food diets are unnecessarily restrictive. I think the idea that the enzymes from a raw vegetable are something that you need and that you'll ruin by cooking it is pure fantasy. Mm. We make our own enzymes from the amino acids that we get from the proteins that we eat, and we don't need the ones that are in the vegetables. Those are serving the need of the vegetable plant, not of the human that eats it. So I just encourage people to eat lots of fruits and vegetables, whether they're raw or cooked is purely pretty incidental.
And your book, Rethinking Nutrition, I'm really glad to mention it again, Connecting Science and Practice in Early Childhood Settings. So if you have a child, this would be a really good book to have.
Right, or to pass along to your daycare provider or the preschool that your kids attend. In fact, I'm giving a talk to a local preschool in another week or two on just this subject. And children like Emily, that this latest caller, I'm sure will come up.
Thank you, Sue. Sue Nitzke, our guest. She's the author of Rethinking Nutrition. And take a look at it. You'll enjoy it. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.